I encouraged a couple that we know to get Netflix, and they're out in Clinton,
okay.
And they do have a rough cable out there.
Yeah. Or according to Russ, you can get fiber optic into your house now. Is that what you're running, Russ?
No, I'm not.
No.
I went in, they wanted to drill a hole in my wall, and I said no. See, they run my cable. The telephone line runs through the electric conduit, and they said they had to separate that one.
Yeah, the fiber optics is a completely different installation.
I remember working 30, 40 years ago with this guy that put in fiber optic cable. I told you about. And he changed this whole area. But he had a main building where all the equipment was, and then he put in repeater stations. I had no idea what we were doing.
Right.
You know, but he was putting a small amount of stuff into these little, into the dirt.
Mm-hmm. Their nodes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is that the reason that out there, where he lives, is that the reason that they can only still get low speeds?
Well,
or can they crank it up at the main thing to get it out there?
You mean out like where Russ is, where Cuesta del Sol is?
Yeah.
Well, fiber optics eliminates the concern for low speeds. As soon as you put fiber optics in, you're dealing with hundreds times faster than you've ever dealt with before, thousands times faster. And if they put in two links, you can double that. I mean, the amount of capacity that can go through a fiber optics, it's very difficult to conceive of. And then across one piece of fiber, I've seen just in probably the last 20 years, they've changed the duplexing of data. So they can shoot. I mean, I'm not a fiber optic expert, but just anecdotally, I've read articles where they've talked about changing the way they multiplex the light going through the cable. So they were able to crank out like 100 times more. So the unimaginable capacity of light.
They've been told by Telmex they can get 1 gigabyte. That's it. That's not enough to do Netflix.
That's plenty to do Netflix.
Gigabyte. They can have, not megabyte, bro.
They have.
One gigabyte should be enough. You can't get it from Telmex. You can get up to from 10 to 16 megabytes right now with fiber optics. And that would be plenty for Netflix. Yeah, that sounds about right.
One gigabyte would be way up there in terms of speed.
Yeah, and they're doing it in the States. That's what those Google fiber connections are. They're 1 gigabit connections.
Whoa.
And when you're going that fast,
am I wrong? Is it one megabit?
Well, 1 megabit would be something worth complaining about, because that would just be on the edge of being able to do Netflix. You'd be doing low quality at 1 megabyte, and there'd have to be something between them and the phone company's installation that's the problem. Yeah, because that fiber optic link that runs down there, what they've done is they've activated it farther down the chain. Like before, for example, and I don't know for certain, but before, for example, it went as far as, say, the old Club Med. And then from there, they branched copper connections to it, and you were limited at DSL speeds. Like you said, you can get up to 6 on yours.
I was also told that I'm not even connected. I'm not even connected to you with my cable.
Well, you're not, but your house is connected to a switch in your area that's been replaced with a fiber optic backbone.
Okay.
And that's why you've been able to see up to 6, because I imagine you pay for that. There's a standard contract.
Standard.
Yeah, most people get from 3 to 6, mm-hmm. and how far you are from that box, it depends on the speeds that you can. Yeah, so you're like, I mean, you could virtually be plugged into fiber optic then. If you're that close to the fiber switch, then there's very little interference. Whereas like my neighbor and I are out on a tail end of the Ranchitos, and we've never been able to get above 4, but what's contracted is 3. Yeah, that's right. And that, that loss, that potential of up to 6 and only being able to get 4, it represents inadequacies between the link where we are and where we need to get to. I mean, it could be bad wires, could be just pure distance, because the farther you go, the more error prone the link is. We've already started streaming and we're already into it. And we're already into it. This is San Carlos Computer Club and I'm Scott. It's March 4th and we're having our regular Tuesday meeting. But we have an irregular small size today. I think we've got like 9 of us here today. I scared everyone off with my friends. They weren't kidding when they thought they were the muscle. Linda's got a question.
Okay. Yeah, we set up these routers at my house.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But little background, Linda's doing free-to-air. She's got a couple of boxes that need to be plugged into the internet. Those boxes need to be plugged into specialized routers that run a piece of software that grabs, well, I don't know how deep we need to get into it, but basically these routers have to be, boxes have to be plugged into routers, and those routers have to be plugged into the internet. And I was over there last week, and the only one of the things Linda's been trying to do is to get 2 different TVs running off of 1 router. And we weren't able to do it. But we did make 2 different TVs work off of 2 different boxes successfully. 2 different routers successfully. And your question is?
The question is, if you're on the network, is it possible that the internet itself could be down? Because we have been experienced since like Friday, our TVs are working,
yeah,
but we have no internet on the computer.
You have no internet on your computer,
right?
But your TVs are working.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
And it's not. There's no internet like on my tablet. I mean, I've checked all of them. I mean, it goes in and out. It's going in and out.
It's going in and out.
Correct.
Okay. So the way we set up your network is we took a cable modem in. So that's the link to the internet. When you think of the internet cloud, that's the cable modem. And then you had a new router, it's a Buffalo router, and we connected it to that, and we made that your Wi-Fi access point. We also used these specialized routers for your TV boxes. They're Linksys routers, and we put one in front of each box and plugged each one of those into the Buffalo router. So it's kind of like a tree here. We've got cable modem, and then we've got Buffalo router, and then under the Buffalo router, we have the boxes for the TV, the 2 boxes for the TV, and Wi-Fi. All that happens across the Buffalo router. So your iPad or a laptop would be hooked up wirelessly. Oh, and we also turned off the wireless points in those other routers. So the only Wi-Fi point that should be available is the Buffalo point. Oh, that sounds correct.
Mm-hmm.
And your Wi-Fi is in and out.
The TVs are working fine.
Yeah.
But the internet on the big laptop and also on my tablets is going in and out.
Are they actually disconnecting from the Wi-Fi? Do you see like a little icon saying that you've gotten disconnected or you're reconnecting?
Well, you know, on the Buffalo router, it's got the little light that points. That looks like a little half moon thing or something. And then my link that's on my modem, it's not blinking. But yet the TVs continue to be on. So it's like they're pulling something from the network, but the internet is down on the laptops and the tablets.
Well,
it goes in and out.
But when you say that, are the laptops and the tablets getting disconnected from Wi-Fi? Or are they staying connected to Wi-Fi the whole time?
It says they're connected to the Wi-Fi,
okay.
But when I click on the internet, both on Google or on Internet Explorer,
sometimes it doesn't pull up pages.
It won't pull up any pages on the tablet.
Okay. So that sounds more and more like there's just an issue with your internet service.
Well, that's what I'm wondering.
Yeah. Because everything's running through that Buffalo router. So if your TV boxes, your FTA boxes are getting internet, then your tablet should be getting internet at least as frequently. Your tablet, your laptop. But what we noticed with your TVs when I was over there was that they could run quite a while without internet. You remember we would disconnect it and it would run for maybe 30 seconds. Yeah. And so you're just watching, which was different than the experience I've had with that other system that Scott Bailey has. If you lose internet for a second, all of a sudden your TV's frozen up. Oh. Whereas Linda's system, if you lost internet for 20 seconds, maybe 30 seconds before all of a sudden the TV would stop working.
It's always been that way though.
So I can only think that maybe there's, you've got a lousy connection through MegaRed, or there's a, what's the word I'm looking for? A randomness, like a sporadic instability in your internet connection.
Mm-hmm.
Because the boxes, if you think about the logic behind the boxes, they're looking for encryption keys. Encryption keys in themselves are not weighty things. They're like text. They're like cookies. In the end, to create them is what takes all the processing power. But to pass them it's nothing. You could probably think of like a strong box versus the key. The strong box is the thing that's so heavy and weighty, and the key itself is nothing. You stick it in your back pocket, and that's essentially what you're downloading is the key at any given time. You're
right.
Downloading the key. And that's a whole different experience than, say, watching a Netflix video or surfing your email consistently with, like, Gmail, where they're constantly updating this web client. If you're having sporadic internet access, if it's unstable, it may be that it's providing the keys often enough for the TV to work, but it still has a real sour internet experience for you.
Well, the telephones were working.
So you're able to make phone calls without
phone
any
calls?
Problems.
Yeah, phone calls, the TV is working, but the internet is going in and out. Now, maybe it's MegaRed. It started like
But you're talking about like a Magic Jack call, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, my Magic Jack seems to be working just fine.
Right.
Huh. Yeah,
that goes all over the internet.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. So
I'm wondering, are you still getting something on the network? Is it just the internet part and the network is still working? Because, you know, when
are you using Chrome for everything? Is it Chrome?
What?
Your web browser.
No, I'm using either. Both.
Okay.
You're
certain?
Explorer and Chrome.
Because one of the things I was going to bring up is I've been having all kinds of problems with Chrome recently.
No.
Yeah.
And
and cross-platform. I've been having problems, not Chromecast, but Chrome the browser. Very specifically with Gmail, using the robust Gmail, the one where you can configure the background.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I use it on Windows XP, Windows 7, my Macintosh, and I synchronize between each one of these installations. And I use Chrome specifically for my bed and breakfast activities for my folks' business. And recently, it's just been crashing all the time, and it doesn't matter which one I'm on. It matters which email I'm in, but it doesn't matter which computer. I mean, it's the most bizarre problem. I've flushed everything out of it, and I set it up like brand new. The only thing I haven't done yet is uninstall and reinstall it, which I was about to do until I started having the exact same problem on Macintosh as I was in Windows. And then I'm like, well, why would that fix the problem? They're completely different systems. It really feels like they've done some tweaking with their browser recently that when you're using, I mean, I've got a lot of stuff happening in my Gmail. I've got lots of labels and folders and contact list stuff, and I don't know, maybe that has something to do with it. But I feel fortunate that I can access it through a different browser, or I can go through my email client on the Macintosh to access the same email account, because it's really hurt me in a couple of places where I was in a hurry and had to run to a different computer to make the stuff work.
I'm having trouble with my backup.
Like you're using the backspace key on the keyboard?
Not on the keyboard. I'm clicking on the arrow.
On the arrow, and it's like it doesn't know that you had a place to go before it?
It makes, you can tell that the arrow worked.
It presses in. You know what? Now that you mention that, I had that experience too on Chrome recently, where I knew that I had been to a half a dozen pages before, and I just kept.
You can't get there.
And the button does its animation the way it's supposed to, so it presses in and gives you an indicator that, that it's working, but nothing happens. You just sit there on the same page.
Well,
you had that experience too?
They haven't seemed to have done
in Gmail.
Upgrade on it.
Okay, well, let's say I probably should go to Firefox and see if I have the problem.
Yeah, if it's, is it on Gmail that you're having that experience?
Yeah.
Specifically Gmail. That's interesting.
When I don't have the problem.
What?
It's when I'm on Google. I have the Google page up and I have my. For example, go to Viva San Carlos.
Okay.
And I can't get, I'll be in and reading something, I can't get back.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Gee, I'm so dumb that I'm happy.
Well, sometimes at Viva San Carlos, you have to go up and hit the community button to go back. I've noticed
I've
that. Now, I don't know if that's something to do with Viva San Carlos is on GoDaddy. I don't know if it has something to do with GoDaddy, but a lot of times I'll have to go and hit the community button to get back.
Sometimes at the bottom, in gray, it'll say waiting on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We may want to just pay more attention to this, those that are using Chrome, and compare the experience to Firefox, because I didn't have the problem when I was using Firefox. I didn't try Internet Explorer. I should try Internet Explorer,
Chrome
too.
Google sent an email saying someone from Mesa, Arizona, tried to get into my account without changing my password. So I did.
Now, Chester, that may be just you floating off and on your VPN. Where does your VPN point to?
My VPN is Phoenix.
Okay.
And they had me in a foreign country at one point.
Yeah.
And then they got me into Los Angeles, and I changed it to Phoenix. But I've noticed that my cloak box, certainly every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock, it has to be rebooted. But a lot of times, sometimes in the morning, I'll have to reboot it. And it's never on Megakey, because I've got the phone hooked into Megakey.
Right.
I always see it's okay. So it's that cloak box.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it's the routers.
Well, next time you experience that problem, going back to Linda's problem, because we've digressed all over the place, and that's what we're about. We have no organization or structure in this crew. So this might make other people angry, but this is just the way we have a meeting.
Yeah.
It didn't come with any set agenda.
So,
maybe.
Just ask him. You said that when you redo the router, your phone's still working, right?
Well, my phone's plugged into Megacable, their router.
Yeah.
Okay, so I go from that router to my cloak box, and my cloak box is the one that has to be rebooted.
But Roy told me in the beginning that our telephones are on a separate thing in there. They're not.
Because
our phone is plugged into the back of the...
No, I'm talking about the Vonage phone.
Oh, the Vonage phone.
I'm not talking about the Vonage phone.
Okay, yeah. I thought you were talking about the
phone. This is all coming through my computer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but what it made me think about is next time you're having problems with the internet, what if you were to just shut off your TV boxes and watch and see if the problem goes away?
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be really extreme.
Yeah, well, at the very least, if all of a sudden the problem goes away, you know it's related to how those are set up and how those are working. Yeah, I mean, it might be as simple as
just a little
so many devices. Yeah, you have a lousy internet connection, and two boxes pulling keys and you surfing the internet is too much for it. It would be a mega cable problem, and it would be related to whatever you've got contracted and however it's installed.
Okay.
And you know, cable is the last technology that I feel like you can. You could be on a length of cable with a crappy connection and be affected by it, the kids coming home from school, because you share that bandwidth with your neighbors because of the nature of cable technology. And if you're on a crappy connection to begin with, then and then you start getting this weight from your neighbors pulling at the same time. I mean, there might actually be a time of day when you're having problems. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Like last night. Yeah. And it, but it goes on and off. It isn't light. It just goes off and sort of stays off. Now last night, it was on and off several times. But I was worried yesterday it went off. And then I tried to
let's
download Nebraska, the movie, and it went fine. So,
I don't know. On and off. Let me just make that clear. That's when you've gone to a web page that can't be displayed.
Correct.
And then maybe you hit refresh and it's there. Like the first time you go to it, it's not there. Or you've been to it, you've been reading it, and then you go back to it and it's gone.
No. Like you go to get onto Chrome or Internet Explorer, mm-hmm. and you get that
page can't be displayed.
No, you get that resolving host at the bottom.
Oh, okay. That would be a DNS issue.
Oh.
Yeah, if you're resolving host and it never resolves.
Right.
That's
what I'm getting when I click on Chrome. You don't get that on Internet Explorer.
Right.
You just get this page can't be displayed.
Yeah.
And when I go, you know, on Internet Explorer, you go, then it asks you to diagnose your network or whatever it says.
Yeah.
And I click on that, it says there's nothing wrong with it.
Right, right.
But on Chrome, it keeps getting resolving host.
Well, resolving host is when the computer is looking for a numeric address based on a name address.
So maybe we should put Google DNS instead of the router.
Yeah, whatever MegaRed's using, because it's going through Buffalo, and it's set, your Buffalo router's set to pull that stuff dynamically.
Yeah.
I mean, that might be a good solution if it turns out being MegaRed's DNSs are having problems. But that's where that information is coming from, because the Buffalo is dynamically grabbing the information that MegaRed's modem is handing it. So all that's been set for you to begin with.
Okay.
And that's in the Buffalo. It's pulling it from the MegaRed modem.
Right.
Right? So you could change that in the Buffalo router.
I think we use the router address. How about if I changed it to 8888?
Well, you could change it to any DNS that you wanted to, but I don't think we set it statically. I think we let the Buffalo pull it from MegaRed as a dynamic allocation. The other routers we set statically to point to the
Correct.
Buffalo.
Correct.
But the Buffalo we didn't set
statically. So where do I change that? On the front page?
Yeah, it would be on the setup.
Down at the bottom, down in the...
Well, it's about in the middle.
Of the front page.
Of the setup page for the Buffalo and that DDWRT. On the front page when you
okay.
go to setup.
So what if I change it to the Google DNS, which is 8888?
Yeah, that's fine. What you probably want to do though is before you change any of that, see what's being allocated to the computers on your network. Like go to the connection, go to your internet connection details.
Well, it's on,
and look at the DNS
automatically.
Well, look at the DNS address that's associated. If you go into the connection, like I'm on Windows 7 here.
Okay.
And if I pull up the Wi-Fi connection.
Okay.
And go into wireless details.
Wireless details?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, yeah, actually it says details dot dot dot.
Okay.
So yeah, on Windows 7, just because I have it in front of me, if I click on the wireless connection, there's a link that pops up at the bottom that says Open Network and Sharing Center.
Yeah.
In the center, it describes all this details about your connection and gives you things that you can do.
Over there by the home?
Mm-hmm. Where, let's see, on the right side of the screen is something that says wireless network connection.
Wireless.
Shows that you're connected.
Uh-huh.
Click on that, and it brings up the details about the connection similar to how XP used to do it. On that window, there's two buttons in the top half. One says details, dot, dot, dot. Uh-huh. If you guys ever look at anything that says dot, dot, dot in Windows, it means there's more to come. So you hit the button expecting another box to come up. And the box that comes up is the wire, the network connections details, and it's two columns, and it has items in one column and values in the other. And under DNS server, you should look and see what the address is.
Oh, okay.
In this case, for Tequila's, the DNS server address is the router. So the router is pulling its DNS, the router has its own set DNS, and then you're using the router as your DNS. So you when you ask for CNN.com, it gets passed to the router you're connected to. And then the router it's connected to has its own DNS, and so it passes that request to its own.
Okay.
So somewhere between those two hops is a DNS that's acting flaky.
Yeah.
Okay.
If it's asking to resolve hosts.
And then where do you change that?
The Buffalo is where I think you're going to want to change it.
On the top page.
Yeah. If it's giving something other than the Buffalo page. Uh-huh. I remember why I wanted you to check this. It may already be set statically to something. If it's not giving you the Buffalo router as the DNS,
okay,
then yes, something is set statically. And that's essentially what you're trying to do anyway. So you should try changing that. Because the Buffalo should be pulling what Megacable is providing. And you're trying to determine if it's Megacable's DNS that's having the problem, or if it's a DNS that we set statically. Does that make sense? I know it doesn't make sense for everybody. I know, but this would be a great review if you're looking for this information. Come back to this podcast. Listen to it 1,000 times. You'll have great questions later.
All right.
Oh, and the reason that makes sense is because after you've attached to a service,
yeah,
you no longer need an address. Like you've already pulled the address. So like say your Magic Jack.
Yeah.
Like as soon as you've attached to Magic Jack is peer to peer, as soon as you've attached to one peer, it's telling you what the other peer's addresses are. They're not determinant on a name address like CNN.com or Yahoo.com. So it's very possible for services to work with a poorly functioning DNS. I mean, it'd be like a phone book that was ripped up and wasn't always available. If you had the number, you wouldn't need to look it up in the first place. So something like your TV sets, they could be looking up the address they need for the server, and that server's address is at least good for 24 hours, but maybe it's good for a month, maybe it's good for a year. After it's made those associations, it doesn't need to go looking up that information again. So it's got some time period that it needs to go look up that information again. It's either forgotten it or it cycles through forgetting it and looking for it again. Like I would imagine the servers, for example, they change so that they can't be found.
Yes, they can.
So they probably have pre-programmed into them, look for a new server address every 30 minutes or every 2 days or every month. But during that cycle program, it wouldn't be necessary to go look that up again. It would know where to find that connection. That numeric address wouldn't have changed since the last time it looked it up. Is this helping anybody? Because we can switch topics.
I'm done.
Sorry, guys. I see glazed eyes. Even Linda wants the information, and I can tell she's getting glazed over.
You lost me about 10 minutes ago.
I'm sorry. Sorry, guys.
No, that's boring.
I should
get
a dose of this picture out.
I'm very sorry. It's hard to make sense out of that stuff. You have to look at it and look at it and look at it, and you have to have background information in different areas before I can just spit it out and it makes sense when you hear it. You know what you're talking about. So let's get back to more interesting stuff.
Yeah. Well, the TVs are working good.
Yeah, that is the moral of the story. The TVs are good. Internet sucks, but TVs are good.
Okay, I have an easy question. Maybe. It's my turn.
Okay, go ahead, Maggie.
Just butt in. I
downloaded some movies on a memory stick, and I gave them to a friend of mine to watch. I have to see if she has a watch.
Okay.
Of course, it would work.
VLC. Have her download.
She has to download VLC.
The VLC media player will play just about any video audio format that you can.
I like
it. But I will tell you that my girlfriend has Mac, and we've used mine on her. We just did it last week. But it's not as easy finding the movie as on Internet Explorer, where you just open up my computer and go to the stick, open up the stick, click open with VLC, and you're boom, you're on. No, you gotta go through this whole rigmarole with the preferences and da-da-da. So she has to figure that sequence out, how to get the stick open.
I might go back to what you said. You downloaded a movie and put it on a stick. Mm-hmm. How did you do that?
I bought it from Amazon.
Okay. You bought it. Okay.
No, I downloaded the movies off of the torrents and then put them on the sticks. I even pirated a pirate. When you download the movie, then just go to my downloads and it's in the movie. It's in there. And then just right click on it and send it to the stick. Well, I'm not sure if you can download anything you bought.
The difference here is something.
She bought it from Amazon.
I'm trying to download the rentals.
copyright problem.
I bought a copy of Torrents. You do a lot of Torrents.
Yeah.
I downloaded it to my computer and downloaded Torrents.
What is Torrents?
Yeah.
But when I open the stick, instead of showing the names of the movies,
Lincoln.
Okay.
When I opened it, there are probably 30 of those little cones.
.to.
30 of them come up. So I just clicked the first one and I let it run until I want to pass. I'm assuming that it's automatically opening each one of them. Why is it
then you need to download.
Okay, so what you've done is a direct copy of a DVD disc. And a DVD disc has lots of, they're called assets. And it's got video clips. It's got various soundtracks, it's got various subtitle tracks, and so each one of those is a different asset in the disc. And so your intention for using VLC is to run that structure as though it's a DVD. And you can do that starting at the folder. If you start at the folder that includes all those assets, you can click on the folder with the right mouse button, and choose play with VLC, and that'll set it up just like a DVD.
I like VLC.
The folder and choose
play with VLC, and then what it'll do is it'll open it. It'll be like you stuck a disc in. It'll come up with the home screen. It'll have the links to play movies or special features or whatever was included in that disc.
Right.
Because what you're really looking at is you're looking at different audio tracks, you're looking at different video tracks, because those are all extra stuff that's on a DVD.
You do that same thing on a Mac? But you're saying once she gets that, she has to download VLC, and then she has to go to the settings or something and confirm it has to go onto it.
Well, what I found with the Mac is I plugged in the stick. Then I had to go to VLC, and then I had to click on the media, and then open the movie.
It seems to me, I've had mine set up for so long, but it does seem to me that VLC didn't automatically, on the Macintosh, it didn't automatically, well, on the PC as well, it didn't automatically assign itself. Well, it didn't automatically associate itself with the video files.
No.
So if you installed VLC, it would try and open your video file still with like QuickTime or something like that. It wouldn't find VLC.
Whoever you put in as your
default media player.
You can change your default video player to VLC.
I've had to a couple times. It opens VLC, will open, but nothing happens.
So then I right-click on it, and I have to switch to Windows Media Player, and then move.
You know, one of the reasons VLC is so popular is because it's a cross-platform video player, which means that it is pretty much the exact same program on Linux, on Macintosh, on Windows. And to associate those files under VLC, it should be the same on each version. And there's a button that lets you select which files would open VLC if you double-click on them. I'm waiting for VLC to open on my computer right now.
Well, VLC, you have to click on media, and then it'll open your...
Well, not necessarily. If you
find the movie.
If you open up VLC,
yeah,
and you go under preferences, under tools, under preferences,
yeah,
and then this is the all the different settings you can have. The very first... Well, what is it? It's a dialog box with a column and a window to the right. And the window to the right says interface settings. It's the very first option, interface settings. And if you scroll to the bottom of that window, there's a button that says set up associations.
Oh.
And on set up associations, if you click that button, what it does is gives you a list of all the different file types that could potentially be used to open VLC. And you can select those right there. So if you have a file type that when you double click on it, it's not starting VLC, look for it here and put a check mark in it.
You mean like AVI?
Yeah, like AVI or MP4 or MP3, AAC, AA3. These are all different formats that we've used in the past. AFS. There's just a slew of them. And so that way, or you can just select all, and that way you've blanketed everything that you could possibly open with VLC. VLC is my main media player all the time. The only exception would be iTunes, and that's because I have an iPhone and an iPod Shuffle, and my wife has an iPhone, we have an iPhone the kids play with. So it's kind of hard to use all that iEquipment without an iTunes installation in the mix. But other than that, we use VLC for just about everything.
Well, you can also, when I was on my friend's Mac, so we had VLC open,
mm-hmm.
I just clicked on media and then went into her and looked for the...
Right, right.
...for the stick, because I couldn't...
Yeah, and you can do that. You can browse to the file from VLC.
Browse to the file off the stick on the Mac.
But by associating file types with the application, then you can just double-click on the file and it will open it up in the media player.
Even in Macintosh?
Yeah, on the Macintosh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I just had a hard time with her, so I just bring my laptop over there. It's a lot easier.
I might need you. I don't know how badly they want to see these movies. But... What is that?
Direct has stopped. I'm not sure. What is VLC Direct? You didn't? But there are VLC applications for Android that are intended for controlling VLC. So you could have a remote control in your hand on your smartphone or your tablet to control what's playing on the TV. I've played around with some of that. It's pretty fun. But yeah, I can... I never bought the application, but you could see the list of all the videos that you have available on your computer in your hand, and you could click a video, and it would start playing it on the VLC installation you have on your... Like, so you have a, like, my installation is a laptop connected to a big screen, and so VLC can be running on that laptop on the big screen. And then with the remote application, I'm able to look, browse the files that VLC has access to and click on the one I want to have play, and it'll show up on the big screen.
Are you doing that with the direct cabling?
Where's the remote?
Well, the laptop is directly cabled to the screen. That's where the advantage is you have the VLC remote control in your tablet or your smartphone. Yeah, so that you're able to control what's happening on the other side of the room.
Ah, okay. So if you're using that, you have to get the TV.
That's right. Right.
Okay. So,
yeah, I'm not. I wouldn't be, and it, as interesting as it was cumbersome enough. I've never adopted to it. I've never bought the full-blown application. Like, the free application gave me enough of a taste of it to go, yeah, that's kind of cool, but it feels kind of, it's just easier to have a cordless keyboard connected to the TV in that case, right? I got a list of files right there in front of my face on a big screen TV. To me, that always makes much more sense. Maybe someday that'll change. They've got remote control software for iTunes as well for doing the same thing. So you can, if you're in the habit of using iTunes for all your video and music, and you have that remotely, you need access to it remotely, you can buy an app for your iPhone, or even they make them for Android tablets as well. Yeah, third parties. Apple doesn't make it, but there are third parties that make it for Android tablets.
This VLC can be, does it have to be downloaded differently on a tablet compared to a laptop?
Well, there are different distributions. There is a VLC, a version for plain content, that is available for Android. I'm not too familiar with it. But it would have its own set of Android features, because it would be a touch screen and that kind of stuff. And I don't believe there's one for iOS unless there's a jailbreak version. Because of the open source nature of the software and its licensing agreements, I don't think that it can actually be in the Apple iTunes store. But I could be wrong on that. If we find out differently, I'll correct myself. But they have a Windows version, a Linux version, a Macintosh version. And then in the past, they've had versions for like cell phones and tablets.
Here's a question that I have.
Okay.
I have one internet provider, and that's where you get your downloads from or your email. If I want to go back to Arizona, my wife stays here, and I have a computer there.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to refer the computer here. How can I do email back and forth? Do I use, like, maybe Gmail for one thing, and let the other mail come through on the normal process? Or how do you,
probably,
how do you recommend that?
Probably probably the best way to think of email is that it's associated with you. Yeah, as an individual, like a serial number is, or a social security number is. And so if you wanted to correspond with your significant other, it would be, she would have her own access. She'd have her own email account.
Yeah, but she does.
But she doesn't.
No.
And then,
you
and that.
Yourself.
Yeah, I know, but if I start the computer up there, it's going to download that.
Okay, you're using email clients.
You follow me? She wouldn't get it.
She wouldn't get it because the computer would pick it up and it's deleting it off the server.
So I was thinking, well, maybe we could set up certain times. Each of us could use a certain time frame.
She needs her own email account.
Okay, how do I get
her own email? Or Skype. Does it do something like that?
I don't have Skype up and operating.
You can go in Gmail and open a bunch of emails.
Gmail?
Well, yeah, Gmail or Hotmail or Yahoo. You can just set up another. There you go. That's the solution. Let her do whatever she knows how to do.
Make
it yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
She gets the one she's familiar with.
You're absolutely right, Mike. It's great advice. Let her do whatever it is she knows how to do, and you go set up a new account, and you associate that with yourself. And that way she doesn't have to change anything about what she's doing.
Yeah.
And you're the one with the new learning experience.
All nice dinner will be very nice.
All of us married folks can attest that if you make her sign up, you're never going to get an email from her.
I was thinking, though, that if you go online, open up your Gmail account online, it's got all your messages on there, both incoming and outgoing.
If you're on Gmail.
Yeah. If you go online and get online.
Yes.
Gmail. It's got them all there. She can, the
Okay.
Like, well,
but you can just email yourself.
What's
wrong with
it? But it would be there.
Well, I know. No, I thought that if you emailed yourself,
it comes up.
Yeah, and
but only on, but if it downloads on one computer,
it downloads it on the other.
It will.
Any computer you open.
No matter.
But it will still
no
be
matter.
Online.
Okay.
And your account is yeah. still there.
Yeah. Your
account's up there.
I mean, you know,
right. Right.
It's on there. It picks up any email she's got at home.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And I just, when I'm with my husband and I'm up someplace,
mm-hmm.
I just email to myself and he picks it up.
Yeah.
It says me on it.
Yeah. Says me.
Yeah, that's right. But that's when you go online and get your account and it says me.
Okay.
So that's what you're suggesting is don't use your mail client back home. Use a web page to go to Gmail.
Yeah.
And then mail yourself and then she'll get a copy of it.
And it'll be there forever until you take it off.
I mean, you only use
But that is not the paradigm we live in.
No,
I use my provider.
And actually, we live in a day and age where that's considered suspicious activities now.
Yeah.
Because isn't that how what's his name was able to have an affair with his autobiographer? The military guy that had an affair with his autobiographer during his time in Afghanistan and came back to a position. There you go. Wait, what did he come back to be? CIA head, or right? And he had to resign because of his illicit affair with his autobiographical author. Yeah, there you go. Wait, I don't know if you remember, but the way they were able to share notes was very similar to that, where they didn't actually send each other email, but they got into a common section. I don't remember exactly what it was, like a note that was shared inside Gmail, and so there was no email records, but they would get in and share this note like they're working on a document together. And that's how they would, they would share their little love notes.
No.
So there'd be no email track.
Because
those things don't leave the Gmail server.
Until you get the stuff. In your account, you can go in and get rid of them.
Yeah, right.
You don't necessarily want it.
But the frustration with email is that it goes out 1,000 different directions. There's nothing that will ever be secure or private about email, no matter what anybody tells you. The very nature of it makes it unsecure and makes it public. Email wouldn't exist unless it was public. It wouldn't function. The protocol requires it to be public. And so that's why they were trying to avoid an email paper trail. Because they were sophisticated enough to recognize that. Hey, Russ, before you go, Mac topic, big security breach on SSLs, and they've already fixed it, but you have to make sure you're getting the latest software update on all Mac platforms. So, if you've gone to software updates, there should have been a 2014-01 update. Yeah. It's on the iPhone, the iPad as well.
Is that a public reason I never open up iPhone?
No, it would be a problem on an iPhone, but it wouldn't be a problem on your Mac. Let me try that again. All iProducts and Mac computers suffer from this problem. And the technical details I haven't quite sorted out yet, but basically, it takes SSL, which is the component that makes us secure and private. And what they've discovered is that it's not so secure and private as they were hoping it was. They found a way to break into it.
Last week, they got the fix for all of the iPhones and little products, but not the computers. So apparently this week, they got the computers.
Yeah, in fact, it's happened since our last meeting. They had an iPhone fix, and now they've got the OS X fix. And so if you've got any of those kinds of devices in your life, you don't want to waste any time. It's a serious security vulnerability. It's not the kind of vulnerability so much that would infect your computer. It is the kind of vulnerability that would make you vulnerable doing banking and credit card stuff.
Sure, embarrassing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why they jumped on it. There was no reason to sit on it. As soon as they knew what was going on, they immediately fixed it. And so we're idiots if we don't take that fix.
Same problem with the Mac, so
So they got a switch out loud for that.
At least I've seen it at 10.7, which tells me they've got to have it for 10.8 and 10.9 because those are the more supported operating systems. If you go back as old as 10.6, I don't have the technical details on it. I don't know if they're bothering to support support 10.6. I'm fairly certain they're not supporting anything on 10.5. So if you have a product still running one of those old operating systems, you should be looking to upgrade in the first place. It's one of the ways that these companies nudge you into upgrading is that they just don't support. And that's one of the topics I wanted to bring up. How much time we have left? Because, okay, we got 5 minutes. Windows XP support, most of you guys know it's leaving. Well, you should have support until April. That's what they're saying. You should have access to the updates and the security updates and the patches.
Just when the screen went blue when I was working on it, so I shut it off.
Right.
I looked through the notes and you said red. So I turned it back on and I got this message that something had happened and I needed to do the following steps to fix it. Update this, update the driver, do this, do that, do everything.
So that's not Microsoft, that's your computer. Something is wrong with you.
That's going to become my computer that I use to stream internet.
Right.
And that's a personal question I ask you.
Well, you know what I'd say is any old computer that you're planning on repurposing and you're going to replace it with a new one, just plan on formatting that with an operating system. Like take all the stuff off of it and then don't even try and make that function anymore. Just plan on formatting it with a clean operating system. Because what you're looking for... Well, actually...
8.1.
Yeah, 8. This opens up a real can of worms conversation. I can't realistically allow customers to keep using Windows XP. Not because it's a bad operating system. It's always been a great it hasn't always, but it's been a great operating system for at least the last 8 years. It's been a great operating system. And so there's nothing fundamentally wrong with it except Microsoft refuses to continue to fix it. It will be worse than not secure. It will be targeted. It will be completely targeted because it uses technology that we're currently using. And when something we're currently using proves to be compromisable, if that is a word, then the bad guys will look at the fix that's used to fix that compromise. And apply the problem, the compromise to the older operating systems. So there'll be, right. It'll be like, hey, look, they don't even have to find it anymore. They just have to wait for the security experts to find the open door. If you're a novice, I can't recommend enough getting out of your Windows XP computer. Microsoft, it is propaganda, but they are saying that Windows XP will immediately become 5 times more vulnerable than Windows Vista, Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows 8.1, simply because they will not pay attention to it.
They shouldn't be opening bank accounts either.
That's right. That's right. And if you're repurposing it for something as simple as maybe you're running a printer on a network over in the corner, or you're using it to watch video on your TV set. Well, you're still at risk of just prone headaches because those security risks will continue to exist. It will sit on your network and collect whatever the latest threats are that your latest antivirus is not worrying about because the operating system manufacturer is supposed to worry about it. If you follow what I mean. We're gonna see because people won't change over. I've got a half handful of XP systems in my lives, and probably only my kid's computer I'll shut down because it sits over in the corner. No, it never gets any maintenance. I rely on the antivirus to update itself, and it's just not worth being a headache in my life.
What are you gonna do? Put Windows 7 or 8 or something on them?
Well, right now that one will probably just go to the trash. It's just too old to mess around with. It can't run any of the new operating systems. And for me, it's just a headache that I don't need in my life. I've got enough computers that I have to administer, and that one was just one they were using to watch videos on. So we'll find another solution. For my kids, it may be time to bite the bullet and buy them a tablet, because they use my tablet 80% of the time anyway. They seldom use that computer anymore because it's so old and slow, so I'll just pull it out of our lives.
Would you recommend that I get one that small? I would really like to.
These are available, but they're actually either Chromebooks, which are that price range, between $250 to $350, or they're Ultrabooks, which go up there as expensive as a regular laptop or more expensive.
That's the one.
They have USB ports, and all I need
is...
That's Toshiba.
Well, yeah, it's not necessarily a specific name brand. This comes out of the netbook generation, and there aren't very many netbooks out there anymore. The only equivalent would be like a Chromebook, which doesn't run Windows. It runs Windows Chrome, Google Chrome operating system.
The one I want is a Chinese company. The Chinese company.
Yeah. Which one? Is it the Lenovo?
Lenovo. Yeah, when you talked
about the Yoga?
Yeah. Yoga 12 Pro.
Yeah, I like how that looks. A 12, are you sure it's not a 13 or a 10? I can't remember a 12.
Maybe it's 13. Yeah. Well, there's a number that's a part of the name.
Yeah, but
it's 13.
I think the number's associated with the screen size. I think, if I'm remembering correctly.
That's
it seems like they've... Yeah.
I think you brought it with him one time.
Yeah, that Yoga, that was a 13, and that one with the keyboard flipped all the way over on it.
That was pretty neat.
Yeah,
they have an update this year.
Oh, really?
It came out, I think, in November.
Maggie, if I had to recommend a computer, I'm really partial to that Lenovo.
Really?
And I'm really partial to the Microsoft Surface Pro 2.
But they're so neat.
The Surface has... I mean, definitely. Well, both of those. One's Microsoft, the other one's Lenovo. Both of them are now tried products in the market. They're just much more expensive than a netbook. They're not $250 computers. Well, yeah, the Surface Pro 2 with the keyboard will run you up to $1,000.
And the Lenovo's
like $899.
Top one, you know, the top one that has...
Oh, the 250, the 6K SSD.
Yeah, 250 the 500.
The 512?
Yeah, 512, and that's...
See, that drive itself is like a $500 drive. I think if you're looking for this size of a device, you're probably more in the market for a tablet type of experience. And you've already got that with the Nexus. Maybe you're looking at replacing the Nexus with a newer, more powerful device.
I saw the other day
there just isn't an ideal PC platform at this price point at this size anymore. That's the real issue. Is that if you're into something like this, and it's kind of my issue too. I don't need more than a $250 computer to do most of the things I'm required to do with a PC. I need a computer that will run old software, will configure old equipment. I mean, I can plug it into routers, I can plug it into switches, I can use it to access components on a server. In my world, that's an old computer like this. It's a good package, it's good form factor. That's not necessarily the best computer for a consumer. Windows isn't proving to be the platform everybody's flocking to, so it's not like you're hedging your bets into the future. The biggest reason to buy a new Windows computer right now would be you're trying to run something from an old Windows computer. And that would be one of the biggest things that would move you that direction. The sad truth about the new Windows platform is it's less familiar to Windows users than the current Macintosh platform. Yeah, because of modern, the live tiles, the direction they're pushing their developers.
I've heard what you have to say, and I've seen people using the Windows 8, and My neighbor has one, and I've played with him a little bit, so I think that's a job.
I just think that when you're looking at buying a new device at this moment in the market, you have to do some soul searching. How really important is it that it's Windows? Which is sad for me. Well, and you have all these options, which we didn't have before. Before you, 10 years ago, you'd go to the store and it's like, am I going to buy a Windows computer or am I going to bite the bullet and pay the extra expense for a really nice computer coming from Apple? I mean, those are your only real two choices. And at different times in the market, you could compare apples to oranges. You could say, well, the processor. Apples to whatnots is actually what it would be.
Or you could do what I did. I bought the Apple and I run Windows on it.
Now, oh, you want to hear something really funny right now? Is that I'm dealing with some old Macintoshes coming in my office right now. And Apple won't let them run the latest operating system. However, you could run Windows 8 on them if you wanted to.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Then why buy the Apple?
Well,
if
you're under a budget, you don't look at Apple. Apple is looked at by people that have more money than they have patience. And that's what they...
I have more patience. I have more
The Apple environment gets better the more money you have. The more that you're willing to buy into the experience and the ecosystem, the easier it is for you. And the more money you have with Apple, the easier the whole experience is.
Well, the issue I have is I do a lot of photography with Photoshop. And with that 27-inch screen that Apple has, and at that time, they were the only one.
But, like, Chester, you could, I shudder to mention HP, but you could get the same size screen.
Now you can.
Yeah, back then you couldn't, you're right. But it'd be a touch screen now, and it'd come in at under $1,000, and it would be an all-in-one device.
Wow. But back then, it was no choice.
Well, and they're using a hinge, which is really cool, where you can float 27 inches down parallel with the table, so you can use your finger on it like a tabletop. So you can drag folders around, files around, or photos around. You can use multi-gestures, like you have a photo in front of you, and you want to zoom in, and you can do this kind of stretch.
Wow.
So there's some really interesting, innovative, different platforms out there, and I just don't think you're locked into feeling like you need to move to the next iteration of Windows. Even though I really like the new version of Windows, that's from appreciation of tech, not appreciation of people's experiences.
So, if all I do is email, search, print, I do slideshows.
Okay.
And I use Word.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
So I don't need $1,000 computer to do that.
No. In fact, a $200 Samsung tablet might do that. What Toshiba's been putting out recently hasn't been necessarily the most innovative. I recommend Toshiba all the time, but it's not on the innovative side. It's on the consumer cheap side. They're selling Windows 8.1 laptops from last year. It's equivalent. Last year's technology was very powerful. They're selling it at discount prices. So you can get into a Toshiba from last year with this year's operating system for between $300 and $600. Any given set of components, and processor speed, all of it's way beyond what you're doing. So you can shop by price. But storage capacity, RAM, and processor, any given collection of those, could add another $150 to that, and it can have a touch screen. And if you're looking at Windows 8, I say go for this touch screen. So if you're looking at Toshiba's, you'd set a budget for yourself, like, I don't want to spend over $600. So you just go down their list, looking at which one at $600 has a touchscreen, and that would probably be the Toshiba you want.
They have both, right? Keyboard and a touchscreen.
Right, because you'd be looking at desktop, you'd be looking at laptop computers. Toshiba does have a tablet line, but that's not what
Windows 8, not 8.1.
It'll be 8.1, yeah.
Didn't you say try not to get it?
Oh, no, you should buy with 8.1, yeah. Yeah. There's some anecdotal stories about people having trouble moving their equipment from 8 to 8.1. And there is, and in the past we've talked about that, and there is a manufacturer's, and if you go to your manufacturer, if you got a computer that has Windows 8, you go to your manufacturer and look at their recommendations for going to 8.1, and they'll have a procedure or they'll have a warning. And the warning will go away with time. Eventually someone will get around to making, yeah, getting 8.1 to work on that particular device. The only reason they would have a warning is because it's cheaper for them to take the flag than it is for them to invest in making that old product work. But eventually, even if it's just their customer base,
yeah,
they'll figure it out.
Given my limited knowledge.
Well, ordering online for most of my customers is more a matter of how long you're going to be in an area where you could. I think people should go out and touch and feel computers. I also think you should put yourself in a position where within a couple of days you can take it back.
Yeah.
Because any given model will suffer some quality aspect these days.
They'll go buy one in Mexico with the Mexican people.
That's a frustration.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you were to buy it here locally, I mean, we can change the operating system, but something like a laptop, you can't really change the keyboard. And you'd quite literally be printing out sticky tabs and sticking those stickers on your keys so that you know where the English keys are. Or you can configure a Spanish keyboard.
I have a Spanish keyboard, but not if it's going to interfere with the regular. So I email in Spanish because I'm just practicing.
Yeah, your two options when you buy a laptop with a Spanish keyboard are configuring for the Spanish keyboard. That means if you have any feel of touch type, your keys aren't in the same place you expect them to be. So you have to look at the keyboard to see what the key is. Or you get a label gun and you print out the keys, and then you can configure it in the system to be an English keyboard, and you put stickies over each one of the keys so you know which one of them is the English key. Those are your real options for a Spanish keyboard around here.
Like I say.
Yeah, I mean, you coordinate it so it's all synergistic. You're going up there anyway, so that's the time to buy the computer. Otherwise, these are the frustrations people have. You have a limited selection down here. There's a lot of HPs being sold down here, whereas up in the States you can see Samsungs, you can see Asuses, you can. Right, you go to a Best Buy, and you can go to the Samsung table, and you can pick up and feel every one of the products.
Is that better than Staples?
Lots better.
Well,
as far as having,
look at all of them, find the one you want,
exactly.
And then go online and start looking for products.
I just wouldn't recommend going into a store ready to buy. I'd go into a store ready to look.
Yes.
I need to spend several days.
Yeah.
It's got those three components you were talking about for price of storage, processing.
Yeah, hard disk.
Speed.
Yeah, hard disk, processor, and memory, RAM. So it's going to be CPU, RAM, and hard drive.
So frequently, RAM can be expanded.
Yeah, but it's amazing what they're selling now. You can get a laptop with 6 gigs to 8 gigs of memory from Toshiba, and it costs like $500. A 15-inch Toshiba with 8 gigs of RAM. I remember computers we used where they didn't have a hard drive that big.
Yeah.
Right?
The processing is measured at so much per second.
Wait, yeah, it's megahertz. Or gigahertz. I'm sorry, gigahertz. It's gigahertz, and it's going to be something like 1.6 or 2.2. But you know what's the real measure now isn't so much the gigahertz as it is the cores. It's either going to have dual core or quad core. And then any of that comes with a trade-off of the faster, the more cores you have, you're trading off battery life.
What's the advantage of choosing that battery?
Well, we now have operating systems that can take advantage of multiple CPU cores. You can think of a core as being like the chip you used to think about. And we used to think of a computer as having a brain. We called it the microprocessor. It's the CPU. It would do one thing at a time. If it did two things at a time, it was virtually doing two things. It wasn't actually doing two things at a time. It had to trade off at millionths of a second, it would be trading off its duties between two tasks. And we did that up till right around Windows Vista.
Okay, example that I have, of course, my computer is 5 or 6 years old.
Well, wait, Chester, let me finish with this, okay? Because what we used to do is like a server, if we wanted to actually do two things at the exact same time, then they would put two microprocessors in it. They'd have two different boards of microprocessors. Then the operating system had to be sophisticated enough to allocate jobs to one processor and jobs to the other processor. That they were trying to do that stuff back with Windows XP, and it wasn't really well put together. It wasn't well put together until about Windows 7 came out, and it was the advances they made with Windows Vista and with the server operating system, Windows Server.
That's my point.
I
have Windows 7.
Right.
If I'm trying to run two programs at the same time, or the labels,
you might be running old programs that can't take advantage of the higher. You might be running 32-bit programs in a 64-bit environment. If you run one 32-bit program, all your other 64-bit programs have to slow down to that speed.
Can I change them all to 64?
Hopefully you can. Now there are some that are negligible. Like I don't think there's a 64-bit version of Firefox. And the only reason for that is because they found that it doesn't slow down your experience. Because of the way they've written Firefox, there's no concern of that. But there are other 32-bit programs that will slow down the rest of your work.
I need to get you over and look at this. I like to run. If I'm doing a movie, or making a movie, and, I may have a 30-minute job.
Right.
And I want to do something else at the same time. Mm-hmm. I can't because it just moves.
Well, so these multi-cores, though, what this is the ability to allocate different processes to each core. So you
have a single core. Then.
No, you should have a dual core. Maybe I don't remember the age. I think it's a dual core that you have. And that's what this is. It's in silicon on the same chip. It's like having multiple chips. And when you have more chips, it takes more battery. Yeah, it takes more power to run that kind of stuff. And so the operating systems, they get more sophisticated now. They recognize you want to do more things, and so they crank those cores on, and they start allocating jobs to those cores. Of course, you pull the plug off your laptop, it's supposed to. I mean, it's debatable how effective it is or not, but the goal is to make it as effective as possible. Recognizing how you're trying to balance battery performance and power. And so it may shut down cores. Yeah, it may decide to allocate the same core to different tasks that when you were plugged in, it would just turn on another core and send that job to the other core. And that's a combination of hardware and software. And you can, how sophisticated your system is, it's kind of what determines how sophisticated your system is.
Is there a way to come and put a program in 32-bit and go to it?
You know, in Windows, if you go to the task manager, I think it lists, at least on a 64-bit system, it lists the ones that are running in 32-bit. If you go and look at the task manager, you look at the processes running under the task manager. It seems like, I'm on a 32-bit system here, and so it doesn't make a distinction. But on a 64-bit system, it makes a distinction. Sure. Well, it's probably a good time, too, because we're kind of coming at the end of our meeting. Let's say, you got another computer question?
Mine's not computer.
This bar?
Spacebar.
Spacebar, okay. All the new computers that I've seen lately, it's one bar. Really? Is that?
Oh.
You're
talking.
Way over here or way over here.
You're talking about the mouse buttons.
Right,
the
left.
Yeah, on the trackpad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, that's not this. This is the space bar, but what you're talking about is right here.
The trackpad
on the laptops, there's this flat surface that you drag your finger across.
Right below that.
Yeah, and those are the buttons for the trackpad.
Right.
Yeah, it's a theme, but it's not necessarily the standard.
Okay.
It's easy to find because it's become more popular, but it's not the standard.
Is it a toggle type thing?
It is,
yeah,
where the it looks like one button, and you press down on the left side.
But it functions the same
way. Yeah, it's way
It is actually something, when you go out shopping for a laptop, it's something to think about. I've definitely used a variety of computers. I don't like the versions that you're talking about with the one button. I've seen others, for a while there, Lenovo was putting out one where the whole trackpad was a button. Right? And so if you pressed on it, it was a button click.
Yeah.
But then if you pressed in the lower left-hand corner, it was a left button click. If you pressed in the lower right-hand corner, it was a right-hand button click. So I found every time I used it, I was accidentally triggering off
a
button click.
That's what I would think of.
Yeah, because I have heavy hands. And I found it very difficult to configure. I didn't like
that. Macintoshes
are like that too.
Yeah, but Mac has only one button. They have a bunch of gestures because it's a multi-touch. So you could do like this and it means something, and you do this and you, all that means something, but they've only got one mouse button. They've just one. And it's integrated into the trackpad now. So they've just got a little ridge to distinguish where the button is, but it's all the same.
You can feel it.
Right, yeah. You can.
It's like they're scrolling that big square. Mm-hmm. They're scrolling, you kind of, it's...
Well, it's in reverse in the PC.
Well, I finally put a mouse on my girlfriend's Macintosh.
So
now
scroll.
I can right and left click on it.
Yeah.
Another thing, out shopping for new laptops, I think a touchscreen is definite. That's more important than worrying about what speed the computer is, how much memory it has, because we have so much memory, we have so much speed now. It's just not a real consideration anymore. I think as you're going forward, Windows 8.1 is what you're looking at, unless you're going to a Macintosh or a tablet. They're the most economically priced. You want to buy a touchscreen without a doubt. You want to have a touchscreen in it. If you want to pay attention to any of the components, the price, the bang for your buck that you want to spend money on, is it an SSD hard drive or is it a traditional spinning disk hard drive? An SSD is like flash memory. It represents, if you buy an SSD, it represents better battery life. It represents non-moving parts, so there's no overheating in your storage. It's basically more reliable. SSD, and it's quite a bit more expensive.
We're getting up there now.
So,
we're just doing email.
Right. But if you're somebody that's not producing a lot of content, like you're not editing videos, you're not editing files, you don't write documents, even if all you're doing is writing documents, working on spreadsheets, keeping financial information, if that's the only things on your computer, an SSD with 64 gigabytes of space or 128 gigabytes of space, that's plenty. And if the device you get has a USB port on it, it should be USB 3. There should be no compromise. You should have at least one USB 3 port on it, because for less than $100, you can add a terabyte of space in a little form factor. Whoops. And that's where you can put any content that you want to save. It's okay, today I do want to edit a video. Well, you can plug in that external hard drive, do all your stuff there through USB 3. And when you leave that project, unplug it, stick it in a drawer, and back to surfing web pages and doing email.
USB 3 port is not a configuration.
No. There is an ad hoc industry standard that if you look at a USB port, it should probably be blue. I don't know if that's actually part of the USB 3 standard, but all the USB 3 ports I've seen are blue. And so,
are they the ones that look different than a regular USB? Yeah.
No.
That one port that's on your laptop now that's got, I don't know what it's called. It looks
different. Probably talking about an eSATA port, which can double as a USB 2 port.
That's what it is. How do we know? It looks different. No, it doesn't.
Yeah. How do we know what's a USB 2 versus a USB 3 port? I've got a year and a half old port.
If they've mixed them, then many times there's a blue port and then the other ports are black or they're white.
Really?
Yeah.
Why did they mix
them? To save money. That's all, just to save money.
So it's the face portion that's the color?
Well, you know what'll happen is that you have a USB controller, and then the device might have a USB hub. So it's plugged into the controller, and the hub might be what they're saving money on. They might have a USB 2 hub that's inside the computer.
So it doesn't make any difference.
Will you see that device manager?
So what they would do is you'll see a bunch of stuff. It won't make sense in the device manager. You can't distinguish one port from the next using the device manager. The only way to distinguish it realistically is if they've indicated it through some marking on the computer. Yeah, it's either in the literature or they've made it a blue port. Now, recently, in the last couple of years, blue has been the color for USB 3. So without a doubt, if you see a blue port, you have USB 3. If you don't see a blue port, then you got to check your manual and verify. It makes a big difference right now when you're buying a product right now because you're being asked to make this distinction between a SSD hard drive or a spinning disk hard drive. And the SSD hard drive is so much more expensive that to offset that kind of convenience, you want to be able to have access to capacity cheaply, and the way you do that is with an external hard drive. And up until USB 3, having an external hard drive slows down the activities you're trying to do. Having an internal hard drive is much faster than an external hard drive. USB 3 changes that. USB 3 allows you to hook a hard drive, as though it's cabled right into the infrastructure, right into the bus. It goes so fast that you could load your programs on it. It goes so fast you can run your projects off of it. And so it makes it realistic to buy a device with a cheap SSD hard drive, knowing that, well, when I do Photoshop or I do video editing, I'm going to be back at my desk and I'm going to hook up an external USB 3 hard drive, and that's where I'm going to do all that work. Because I wanted the Microsoft Surface with 128 gigabyte SSD, right, for that reliability, for the battery life, for the speed. I wanted that, but I didn't want to pay that. Like a 512 gigabyte SSD can run you $500. So given any computer, you add that device to it, it adds $500 to it.
You want an SSD with at least one USB.
That's right. Yeah.
To save money.
Right. Well, if you want to get into the SSD for the battery life and the reliability and the speed, then you're looking at these price levels, those price tiers, and it's all based on capacity you're willing to pay for.
What are you doing? What are you choosing?
I'm happy to answer any emails.
For 400 pesos.
Yeah, for 400 pesos. Well, 400 pesos, maybe an hour. Might be able to talk into that. But no, Matt, you can send me an email of what you're looking at. I'd be happy to give you my opinion of it. I just think
some up online, and maybe I make a decision, I'll send it to you and say, I'm on the right track before I even go.
Yeah.
Because they're so busy, especially in
it's hard to.
So busy. If they know you're just looking and you're not going to buy, they don't give you much attention.
Right.
I don't have experience.
I just think that we live in a day and age now where you're not just looking at buying the next iteration of Windows. You really do some soul searching and see what you're using a computer for, because there's a computer for everything now. I just recently heard about this, and I can't remember the name of it. It's Auto something. I gotta look it up. It's a device that's being sold now that you can plug into the computer interface in your car, the diagnostics interface.
Really?
Yeah, and it's accompanied by an app in your cell phone, so then you can take control of all that information on the fly in real time. It'll tell you how much it costs for you to drive to work. It'll tell you, it'll shoot off all the check engine light warnings to your phone and give you a log of all the things that are going wrong in your car.
That
Chester has? Yeah.
Chester has?
Yeah, very much like that. Now, his is a proprietary system. Now, he had to have some special device installed. But now this is more like a consumer electronic device. And you just plug into your
and it reads all that stuff.
And it reads. Yeah. Before, you had to go to a mechanic or go to an AutoZone, and they plug in their computer. Yeah. But now they've got this device that you can plug into your own car and all the time, real time, at your phone. Yeah, you plug in. There's a diagnostics port on all these new cars, and new being relative, like since '85 they've had a diagnostics port. Yeah, I mean, because there's been car computers for a long time. They're much much simpler in the '80s than they are now, but this standard of diagnostics port has existed for a long time now. And that's always been my thing, is, well, why can't I just plug it in? I bring a laptop out and find out what my car is telling me. Because what we get as a consumer is check engine.
Right.
That's it.
You open the hood, it's still there. But you bring it to AutoZone, they plug a computer in and go, oh, yeah, cylinder 4 is misfiring.
Right, yeah.
And there might be some subtle history there, like, yeah, it's misfired 4 times. But then when they check it, they reset it, they watch it, and then you watch to see if it goes off again. With this kind of a device, you'd have an ongoing history. You can see not only was cylinder 4 misfiring, it did it 4 times last month, it did it 5 times this month. I just learned about it. I'm just like probably yesterday I started hearing. So I can't even remember the name of it. I got to go back. I think it's a very cool idea though. Well, I don't know anything about cars either, but I mean, you could know enough to add this to your car.
Yeah, it makes it simple.
Right, and you can go into the mechanic and go, hey, my car's telling me that it's been misfiring every third Thursday. So that's the day I drive to Empalme. It's so on long drives, it keeps misfiring. Or it gets warmed up, and it would be very cool to have. Every car is there. It's under the dash somewhere, but every car is there. Well, then it's got to be easy enough for a mechanic to get to it. To plug in a computer. Well, it could be.
You can always ask if you have a Chevy, you could probably go to the place here in Lima's and just say, where's this port?
See, this sounds like this great new innovative technology that we can take advantage of. What the truth is, this technology is integrated into all the new computers that are coming off the line. All the new vehicles coming off the lines have the ability to track all this information. And they've got a way of reporting it, and you can buy into, maybe it's a wireless service, so you have to pay a monthly fee to have access to it. Each car developer has their own way of addressing that kind of stuff. But the point is that the technology to get that kind of information out of a new car is relatively simple. It's getting it out of an old car that's difficult. And that's why we see this as an innovative product. Who really changes their car as often as they change their computer? So I see this kind of product as it's going to be like this flash in a pan. We're going to have a couple of years where this is like the latest, newest innovation. It's going to be really popular. Geeks are going to be buying them and sticking them in old cars that they like
to
drive.
That's funny. I'm not driving a 95 Chrysler. What is it? Dodge Caravan.
Yeah.
So, and there's a port in there somewhere?
There's a port in there to plug in a computer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So can I type in, why am I leaking oil?
Eventually you will be able to. Eventually you could imagine that kind of data, that there'll be services out there to analyze that data for you.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be as simple as, like you said, it's a Dodge Caravan from 95, and you just send it your data, and it spits out what that would mean to a Dodge Caravan. Big data is amazing. I mean, what we're doing with processing data is just, it's mind-boggling. You cannot wrap your head around this voice-to-text stuff where you go to a Google Chrome browser, and on some of the oldest computers that I have, I can hit a button on Google Chrome, and it will almost 99.5% accuracy translate what I'm saying into typed words for a Google search. And not only that, none of that's happening on the computer. You only need enough computer to send it back to Google services to be processed in like the blink of an eye and sent back to you as words. So it's just, you can't comprehend how quickly we are. And then if you were to wrap your head around it today, well, 18 months from now, that's going to double.
Maybe out of maybe 18 months.
We're not getting any smarter. No. I'm not. I won't remember anything you said in 10 minutes.
Well, that's why I record this. And thanks, that's a good segue into finishing this off. We're 15 minutes, oh no, we're 30 minutes over our normal run time. It's 10:50 now. We normally run to 10:15. This is Scott Stimson. This has been the San Carlos Computer Club. We meet every Tuesday in Tequila's here in San Carlos. We meet here at Tequila's from 9:15 to 10:15, but people like to show up maybe at 8:30 or 8:45 and have breakfast at Tequila's. Tequila's does a great breakfast and they take good care of us. So we like to mention it. If you're ever in San Carlos, you ought to stop by. Stop by on a Tuesday, have breakfast, and then stick around for the meeting. We talk about tech topics that matter to people that are living here in San Carlos, most specifically Americans, but in general tech topics of all sorts, and whatever we find interesting. We end up talking about a lot of TV and VPNs and streaming and stuff like that, making phone calls, things that matter to us as expats living in a foreign country. If you're looking for computer help, you could always hit me up. I'm Scott from International Computer Solutions. You can find me through the website, internationalcsi.com. You can also find me through the Computer Club website. It's sccclub.org. If you weren't able to join us for the live stream, you can always go there and listen to a recording. Later this week, I'll put this recording up. I had some friends in town last week, so it took me till today to get last week's recording up. And I noticed a significant drop-off. Normally, I have about 6 to 12 people listening to recordings throughout the week if I get them up right after our meeting. If I wait till the next week, I get about 3 people listening. So, give you an idea, there isn't a lot of people listening in the first place. So I can basically say whatever I want. Anyway, if you were with us and you enjoyed this, please come back next Tuesday. Otherwise, tech on, and I'll see you next week.